Hi, I'm Grant Wall, and welcome to the Planet Football Podcast, where I go in-depth with the most intriguing people in the world of soccer. In this episode, I'm joined by Pablo Maurer, who covers DC United for The Athletic. Pablo is one of the most interesting people I've ever met in the American soccer community, and I think you'll understand why after listening to our interview. Just a quick reminder, it's a huge help if you subscribe to, rate, and review the podcast. It helps people find us. Onward! Our guest today is one of the great Renaissance men of American soccer media. You may know Pablo Maurer from his DC-based soccer coverage, formerly in DCist and now in The Athletic. You may know him from his remarkable photography, especially the Abandoned State series that ended up in National Geographic. You may know him from his podcast, Open Wide for Some Soccer, or from his work as a mechanic, which most recently included work on what appeared to be multiple Lamborghinis. You can find Pablo on Twitter at MLSist. Pablo, thanks for joining me.
Thank you. I really, really knew the ego boost you just gave me. I've never been introduced like that. I really appreciate it.
I should just hire myself out for this stuff.
Yeah.
There's a lot to talk about here, as you can tell from that introduction. And first off, congrats on joining The Athletic in D.C.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate it. Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to getting back to covering soccer more regularly. I sort of, was doing it more sporadically for the past year. So it's obviously a good time to fire up D.C. United coverage again. A lot of stuff going on around the club. Yeah, so.
No, definitely. You're now working under a legend at The Athletic, D.C., in David Aldridge. How come I never saw something from you called Why I Joined The Athletic?
Like 10 people tweeted that at me, and I, or just jokingly just tweeted Why I Joined The Athletic by Pablo Maurer. So I wrote a very short essay. It's like a sentence long, and it's basically that, they pay well and they respect my creative vision. It doesn't take a lot for me to hop on board. You know what I mean? These days there are a lot of outlets that don't do either of those things. So I'm definitely excited.
Well, fill me in. What are you going to be doing for The Athletic?
Just DC soccer coverage. I mean, primarily DC United. Maybe some longer stuff. I've always liked writing long. I mean, most recently for them, I sort of tagged along with Espanol, the La Liga side. They had sort of a really interesting visit to Richmond, Virginia, which is just a totally random place for a La Liga side to spend a week, you know. So they sent me down there, and I kind of tailed after them and wrote about the experience. Have a couple of other longer things coming out, so a little bit of everything, a lot of DC United coverage.
Let's talk about DC United. I also want to talk about the Espanol story, which I really enjoyed a bit later on here. There's a lot of excitement around DC United, which is a sentence I didn't think I would be saying in the year 2018 or any year after 2004. Stadium, Wayne Rooney. Give me a sense of what the vibe is like around DC United right now.
Yeah, you know, it's a little surreal, man. I mean, I started covering the team in 2011. They've had a couple of decent years since then, but even their decent years were years where they sort of ground results out, played pretty unattractive soccer, drew really poorly at a stadium which was obviously dear to my heart, but was just a total dump. Nowadays, I mean, it's a lot to handle all at once, you know, between the new stadium, which I think it's something a lot of us who've lived in D.C., like I've been here for 13 years, and I don't think I thought it would ever happen, honestly. Mm-hmm. That's obviously been a lot to take in. And the Rooney thing is truly surreal, honestly. I mean, I think fans of the club here in D.C. and people who cover the club, like myself, have just gotten used to, more budget-minded approach. And it's, sitting next to Seth Bertelny, a good friend of mine, and writes for goal.com, was sitting next to him on Sunday and just turned to him and I said, it's still really strange to look out there and see Wayne Rooney roaming around, and what you said is sort of spot on, because there's a lot of people asking me about the club, both on the internet and just in person, that I never even thought would, you know, would never even have even thought to go to a DC United game or even pay attention to them. So definitely the club is getting some traction here in the city that they haven't had in, I mean, over a decade, honestly.
Do you like the new stadium, I assume?
I'm getting used to it. I'm a little underwhelmed generally, given the price tag they're putting on it, which, you know, the building and all the land, you know, the cost to prepare the land, they're saying it's $500 million, which is, you know, a crazy amount of money. And you sort of look around the league. I always, you know, look at Banc of California Stadium and sort of salivate and think of what could have been. You know, I will say there are a ton of positives. You know, I mean, every seat in the place is a good seat when they get fans in there, and you know, they make noise, the noise stays in there. It's a real loud place to play. I mean, definitely has a lot of potential, you know, but I guess I'm a little underwhelmed, you know, just because the bar has been raised over the years. You know, and I don't know that the Audi Field really meets that. But, you know, your friend Brian Strauss, he's fond of saying just the fact that the stadium exists is so crazy that, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, don't exactly care about how the stadium is, or, you know, the amenities, or whatever you want to say. So
when they say $500 million, I always sort of took it that they included this new training ground plan as part of that. Are they actually saying that the $500 million is just the stadium and stadium alone on its property?
Yeah, the stadium and the land that it sits on. Now, I know there's sort of been rumblings here in D.C. that the cost to, you know, for environmental remediation, that sort of stuff, because the stadium was built on what used to be a scrapyard. Mm-hmm. And I think the soil is pretty contaminated. I think that those expenses, there were overruns there that weren't anticipated. And mm-hmm. so there were then things in the stadium that were, you know, people in the business are fond of calling it value engineered, you know, out. you know, I think, and I also, and I don't know that it's been reported, but the, you know, the roof, for example, have you been to the stadium, or
I have
you
not still yet. Haven't been?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's open patches in the roof, right? There's like, the roof is sort of looks half done. And I had a conversation with a team official a couple of weeks ago who told me that, yeah, indeed, in the off season, they're planning on sort of filling in those open areas. There are season ticket holders who told me that they get renewal calls where the salesperson is like, yeah, the stadium is unfinished, you know, so I think they were on a pretty tight schedule, Grant, to get it done. I mean, I went about, I don't know, a week before the stadium opened, and they had permits posted in the stadium offices, and they had been working, you know, they had been working overtime, I think, for months at that point, you know, to get it done. So, again, just minor miracle that it even exists, I think. So,
yeah, in terms of Wayne Rooney, one of the big stars of world soccer over the last 20 years, I love the idea that Acosta calls him Senor Wayne. I hope everyone calls him Senor Wayne at this point. What's it like covering him, and has he been good to work with in any sense? I know it's a huge adjustment for him to come to a place where he has to talk so often to the media.
Well, so there's two sides to that. I mean, I interact with him on a weekly basis, and he's been nothing but a pleasure to deal with, honestly. I think you're totally right in that it has taken some getting used to for him to just have, you know, random dudes like me walk up to him in a locker room. On the other hand, you know, I think he sort of embraces it because the random dudes like me that are walking up to him in a locker room aren't asking him about his wife and kids and, you know, his personal life, any troubles he may have had. I think most of us are concerned about the soccer, you know. So in a way, I think, you know, maybe the format of the attention is a little different, but, you know, as far as the scrutiny that he's under, it's, you know, undoubtedly less in the United States than it is in Britain. I mean, I will say there have been games where, you know, for example, the coach's press conferences run long, and, you know, half the players are gone by the time you get to the locker room, and Rooney has waited around the new media. So I think he's embraced it, you know. The hype the hype about him sort of being incredibly hardworking and leading by example, it took just a couple weeks to realize that that was, you know, pretty much 100% true. I mean, the guy works probably harder than anybody else in training. It's very obvious he's not above doing anything. You know, I think the team, when he first joined, offered him, you know, to offer to fly him privately and to, you know, house him in his own hotel room, etc. He declined all that stuff. He, you talked about Lucho. You know, they offered him Lucho's number, which was his obviously traditional number. He declined. Hmm. You know, so I think he's fit in really well. And yeah, I have zero complaints about any interactions with him. I actually feel pretty comfortable speaking for most of the guys in the beat when I say that too.
Does he go out in DC at all?
I think so. Ironically, man, I mostly read about that in the British press because they, it's crazy. They, like Daily Mail, all those places, they have people over here, like, taking photos of him and his kids. I saw a photo of him, I think, just out for a walk in Georgetown. And, you know, his wife was with him. She, like, popped into a psychic there. You know, so I think he is going out, but you know, I haven't seen him around. I don't think he goes to the kind of bars that I do, Grant. I'm not positive. You know? Yeah.
So I want to know about you a little bit here. How did you get into soccer writing in the first place, anyway?
I barely even remember. I mean, I grew up. My parents are Spanish, right? So mm-hmm. I've always been. A huge soccer fan. It just sort of runs in the family. My parents are also both writers. And, you know, I've always written, and I think just probably in 2010 or 2011, I got hooked up with an editor at DCS to asked me if I wanted to do some DC United coverage for them. And, you know, I kind of jumped at the opportunity. I mean, I've always observed MLS. I guess I've never really supported a team. You know, when I moved to DC, I didn't really, you know, I went to a couple United games, but I didn't really support the club, I guess, you know, so I just viewed it as an opportunity to get paid to watch soccer. I think that's the way most people view soccer writing. So
what's your sense of soccer's place in Washington, DC, both in history and kind of how that history, we might see some of it in present day?
DC is steeped in soccer history, right? I think so much of that has been forgotten. I was working for a long time on an oral history of the Washington Diplomats, and I talked to like 35 or so players and, you know, collected a lot of old photographs of the team. Tony Quinn, who's like a legend in these parts, he's a you know, one of the great American soccer photographers. He basically just handed me, you know, two Rubbermaid containers full of negatives from the 70s and said, "Here, these are yours. You can have them." You know, I think DC United, obviously. I mean, you know, they lost so much of their luster in the, you know, I guess late, you know, in the, we'll just say in the past decade, but you know, they were giants in MLS, obviously, and you could make an argument that their fans sort of pioneered a lot of the fan culture that you see in MLS nowadays, you know. So, I mean, there's a lot here. That's not to even go into, you know, there are other teams, the Darts, the Whips, the, you know, the second incarnation of the Diplomats, the Washington Stars, the Warthogs, I don't know, the Baltimore Blast, if you want to broaden it out a little bit, you know. It is. It's definitely an underrated soccer town, I think. You know.
Now, did the NASL Team America play in DC as well?
They did. I'm surprised I forgot about them. I did like a real, real deep dive into them for MLS a few years ago. They played for a year at RFK. What a weird idea that was.
Which was to have guys from the U.S. national team play together for a club team.
As a club in the NASL, yeah. It cracks me up because they had, at the time, they had the largest sponsorship deal in the history of American soccer, and it was Winston cigarettes. I mean, like, not something you'd see much of these days anymore, I don't think, you know. Although you still get, you know, there's still other malign influences. I guess now it's like pyramid schemes that sponsor teams in MLS. So I don't know.
I mean, speaking of cigarettes and DC soccer, I think of Johan Cruyff. Now, you've done stories on all of this stuff, which I would suggest that people go and read, whether it's Team America, whether it's The Dips, which included Johan Cruyff. What did you learn about Cruyff and his DC experience doing that story, the reporting for it?
You know, it's funny, he came here, the reasons why, for example, one of the reasons Rooney cites for coming to DC, you know, you always hear every player, like a Rooney or Thierry Henry, whoever, say that they can sort of walk the streets undisturbed, you know. Cruyff arrived in DC from Barcelona, and I mean, his family were like getting death threats, you know, he was in a very bad place. And very quickly, he settled into life here. And, you know, Thomas Rongen, that's a guy who needs no introduction in these soccer circles, I guess. But he lived with Johan Cruyff. He was just like young Dutch kid. He lived in the basement of Cruyff's house in Georgetown. You know, the Cruyffs, they lived next to the Kennedys. You know, I mean, get this. Johan Cruyff used to ride his bicycle from Georgetown to RFK Stadium to train every day. Yeah, that's just completely insane, right? I mean,
Dutch.
Yeah, but he was everything you always hear about Cruyff, just sort of his domineering personality and him being difficult to, you know, a difficult teammate. 100% true when it comes to diplomats. I mean, you talk to guys who played with him, and they all say the same things. The first one is, he's the greatest player I've ever seen in my life, and, you know, this, that, and the other thing. The second one is, he never stopped smoking. He would smoke like half a pack of cigarettes at halftime. Ugh. Right? And the third one is that he was just like, you know, all of them said the same thing. He would stop in the middle of a game, raise his arms to the sky, and just start screaming, I can't do this. I can't do this right now with you people. You know, he called them a beer league team, I think, once in the locker room. There are players who describe him like clearing the coach's instructions off the blackboard and saying, no, this is how we're going to do it. You know, Don Drogi, who's a defender on the Diplomats, he actually told me that Gordon Bradley, at the time the coach of the Dips, wanted to give Drogi like some, you know, a pregame sort of tactical instruction. And he did it in a bathroom stall. And before he even did it, he looked under all the other bathroom stalls to see if Cruyff was anywhere near him. So, like, the head coach was terrified, right, of Johan Cruyff. I mean, like, so, yeah, that it's totally fascinating to talk to. One of my biggest regrets is I didn't get to talk to him before he passed away. I was in touch with his people, and he seemed very interested in talking. But I, like so many other people, had no idea how much his illness had progressed, and the fact that he was, you know, in risk of dying. So it's unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, I remember covering the 2000 MLS Cup final in D.C. between Chicago and Kansas City, and Cruyff came because Stoichkov, his former player at Barcelona, was playing in that final for Chicago, and we all went and interviewed Cruyff at halftime, and it's pretty rare that you get that close to a living legend, you know? It was pretty.
He is. I managed to track down and acquire a game-worn Cruyff Dips jersey, and as much as it paid me to do it, about 2 months ago, I stuck it in a mailer and sent it to the National Soccer Hall of Fame.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I take so much pleasure in sort of, like, be, you know, writing at my desk and glance over my closet and see it hanging there, right? But I mean, at the same time, it's, like, something that other people should put eyes on, you know, so nice. I look forward to seeing it there, yeah.
Very cool. I want to ask you about your Abandoned States series of photographs, because if listeners haven't seen this series of photographs that you did, they're incredible, and they got an amazing amount of attention, as they deserve globally. Could you tell the story of what Abandoned States was?
Yeah, I've been doing a series for maybe 6-7 years of photographs of now quote unquote abandoned places. So I'll do typically a longer essay about the history of the place. I'll track down some some people who are still alive who remember how it was, and then usually I'll just go and break into the place now and take photos of it. The piece you're referring to, I did some before and after imagery. Basically, I was in an abandoned resort in the Poconos, and I found this matchbook on a desk in one of the offices, and I realized that the photo on the matchbook was of the pool, which was like right underneath me. It was on the bottom floor, so I went down there and kind of tried to recreate the image on the matchbook, and from there I started going to antique stores in the Poconos and Catskills, eBay, wherever, find old, you know, postcards of resorts, and did six or seven other places, sort of overlaid the images and animated them, so it kind of looks like you can sort of see the decades of decay in a matter of seconds. And then I wrote a short essay about it. Yeah, I mean, it really definitely really resonated with a lot of people. And, you know, I hate saying this, but I knew it would. It's like, it is a, you know, it's just sort of a, the images are powerful. I mean, it's something we can all relate to, kind of like loss and the passage of time. For me, you know, it was great. The piece blew up, and it was in all kinds, you know, got picked up by all kinds of other outlets. The most important thing to me was that Pee Wee Herman retweeted it.
No way.
But, you know, yeah. It was like that. It was, you know, several of my, like, Pee Wee Herman, Nico Case, one of the Mythbusters. It was a really random collection of people, all of who I adore, right? So, to me, the geek cred that got me was worth it, you know?
I mean, yeah, it really, really is cool. I remember the first time, because you posted some of these over time before.
I did, yeah. I mean, it took me 3 or 4 years to do the Poconos and Catskills thing. I mean, it was like probably 10 different weekends over a 3-4 year period. So yeah, I would occasionally sort of like let some of them trickle out, you know, but.
Well, it was just, it was really cool to see it go viral the way it did. You know, I guess one question I would have is, where did that side of you come from, the photographer side?
That's like just growing up as a weird kind of dorky, overweight kid, not having a lot of friends, which leads you to do things like just get on your bicycle and ride to the other side of the city and, you know, explore weird places. I mean, a lot of credit has to go to my dad, who, like, he's definitely the kind of guy who, like, if you're riding along with him and you know, just off the side of the road, he sees like an old set of railroad tracks or something like that, he will pull the car over, right? And like, you will start walking down them. Definitely, like, I definitely remember having long days with my dad, just doing things like walking down railroad tracks or exploring old buildings like that. I mean, nowadays I'd probably call Child Protective Services or something like that. But back, you know, back in the 80s, you could just go with your dad and walk down some railroad tracks and nobody was like, call the cops, you know. So eventually, you know, I've always been exploring the places, and it got to the point where, like, people are always like, oh, what's it like there? But then nobody actually wants to go, right? Because it's creepy as shit and you could get arrested and whatever, you know. So I started taking photos of them, and then I'd been writing on, you know, DC United for a while, and I thought, well, you know, I bet some people would like to see these photos, so maybe I could take a swing at publishing them. So wow. The rest, I guess, is history, you know.
Did you ever have any trouble with cops on some of these shoots?
Oh yeah, man. I got in one of the Poconos resorts, I very memorably, and I wrote about this, you know, I'll tell the whole story. It's about, so I could do it in like 3 minutes. Okay. I think I've told it a lot of times. I was at this resort with a friend, and we were in the top floor of this like 70s lounge area. There's this like vinyl clad heart shaped bar. Wow. And this sort of like Knights of Arabia style lounge. And, you know, it was very few people knew about the place. So it was like untouched. It had been sort of closed for 15 years. So I was doing a long exposure. Right, so I just sort of open the shutter and you wait like 30 seconds, a minute, or whatever, and it's completely quiet, right? And all of a sudden, I hear this car door shut. You know, you hear the sound of a car door outside, and I just immediately, I was like, "This is not good," right? So I turned to my buddy and I was like, "All right, so we're just gonna walk out the front door and like make our presence known." I just thought it was probably like the person who owned the place, right? Mm-hmm. So we start walking towards the front door, and outside I see like a police dog and a SWAT team, right? It's like the Pennsylvania State Police, and I'm like, this is not ideal. I came around the corner sort of like with my hands up and my camera in one hand, just like a baby going like, I'm a photographer, you know, like I've never felt dumber about myself than I did in that moment. But it was crazy. We got on the ground, the police dog was like barking at us. I didn't realize this, but I guess they train police dogs in German because like,
what?
I think it's probably, yeah, it's probably to keep, because I assume they don't want the person they're arresting to be like, don't bite me. And the dog like bites them. So I was like terrifying Pennsylvania State Police officer yelling in German while this dog is like staring at me. These guys have like AR-15s. So eventually they get us up and he's like, the one cop goes, I mean, I don't understand why y'all are in this building. I mean, don't y'all have girlfriends? He said to me, I don't know what he was insinuating, any number of things, right? But like, but yeah, eventually they wrote us citations and they let us go, you know, but it was interesting. Anytime you end up like looking at, like staring at an AR-15,
yeah.
Just for like taking a photograph, you know, it's a little ridiculous. But yeah, that stuff happens. I mean, to be totally honest with you, Grant, most of the time cops are just like, just get out of here.
Right.
You know, like they don't want the paperwork, I don't think, you know, but.
Right. Wow. Well, it's very cool. Will you shoot? Like, do you still shoot photography at DC United games, or are you mostly writing these days?
Yeah, I did. I haven't done it a lot this year. Last year, I sort of like, as you know, I'd mentioned to you that I got all those negatives from Tony Quinn. It sort of inspired me to try and shoot film a lot, mm-hmm. which is sort of a nightmare when it comes to sports. Obviously, modern sports photographers, you're just used to like spraying exposures, and you know, you could shoot 1500 images in one game easily. Mm-hmm. You have to be a lot more conservative when film is involved. So I did all of last year. I shot film and it was incredibly humbling, right? Mm-hmm. It made me a much better photographer and it made me like deeply appreciative of every sports photograph I see, you know, from the mid-90s back, right? Because those dudes were really doing it, you know, like it's just so much easier nowadays on digital, you know. Mm-hmm. I haven't done a lot this year. I think I'll probably start doing it when it cools down a little bit. I'm a person who sweats a lot, Grant, so, you know, the last thing I want to do is, not too much, here's my other gripe about Audi Field. There's zero parking, right? So, okay. Like, the team graciously will give you a parking pass, which I'm appreciative of, but the parking lot for a lot of these games is, and I'm not making this up, it's 1.2 miles away from the stadium.
Oh, wow.
So, like, I'm not trying to walk back to my car with 1,000 pounds of gear or whatever at, you know, midnight over, you know, to go over a mile or whatever. So, I don't know. I'll probably shoot a couple games before the year ends, but so far I haven't really done it.
Well, I remember one time, and I've worked on a bunch of stories over the years with Simon Brody, who's an exceptional photographer for Sports Illustrated, and... yeah, we should get him on the podcast at some point as well. But
yeah.
We were doing a story of Diego Maradona's testimonial in Buenos Aires back in 2001, and that stadium is in sort of a rough part of town. But they literally took all the photographers and all of their expensive gear in a van, like the organizers, like a mile away after the game in the van so that they wouldn't have to take their gear through an area where they might get robbed.
Well, sounds like RFK. It's crazy.
I always said RFK was the closest stadium we had to a Latin American soccer stadium. I think it still is.
That's 100% accurate. I mean, first of all, it's concrete, right, which you never see anymore, and
right.
It's like that's like a hallmark of those like huge South American stadiums. And you know, it's crumbling. It's a little unsafe.
Yeah.
Smells bad. There's all kinds of animals in there. You know. Do you know people talk about the raccoon a lot? Did you know that there was a whole family of feral cats,
really?
Underneath the quote unquote bouncy stands where the supporters were. And one of these cats one day got out and got tangled up in the netting of a practice goal.
Oh, wow.
And they had to amputate the cat's leg.
No way.
Afterwards. But one of the stadium staff adopted it and named it RFK. It was kind of a weird RFK tidbit, but The weirdest animal I ever saw in there, but there was like a fish. You see dead fish everywhere.
Huh.
And like you could never figure out what the deal was, and then you realize that like migratory birds were like, they'd pluck these fish out of the Anacostia and then drop them in the stadium accidentally.
Wow.
But occasionally fans would show up and there'd just be like a dead fish on their seat, you know. Just like the place could get any worse, you know, like.
Yeah. I want to ask you about your mechanic work, because I, as someone who does not know a thing about auto mechanic work, I actually really enjoy seeing the stuff you post on your Instagram and elsewhere about what you do. Where did this come from? What is this side of your work life?
I mean, I was also always the kid who was like taking apart the microwave,
yeah,
and stuff like that. I mean, definitely frustrated my parents, like just sort of disassembling everything in the car. So, I mean, I went to high school and I went to college, and eventually at some point in college, I realized that I'd rather work on cars. So I quit and got an associate's in auto stuff. And over the years worked my way up, just from a first job I ever had was at a, it was like a mom and pop garage in Glen Ridge, Illinois, outside of Chicago, working on, it was like a retirement community. So all I worked on were like Cadillacs and stuff like that. And then over the years, I worked at a Land Rover dealer. I became a Land Rover master tech. From there, I worked for Ferrari for a few years. And now the past like probably 6-7 years, I've just worked at a couple of independent repair shops here in the DC area that service Highline cars, exotics, that sort of stuff. So, I mean, it was, I don't know, it's something I've been doing as long as I can remember, you know, and I think that the first car I ever owned, I took apart and put back together like 10 times, you know, just to figure out how everything worked. So
when you post photographs of like a Lamborghini a couple of weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
What are you doing with it?
That was, I should mention, by the way, I needed a quiet place to have this conversation. So I'm actually sitting in a customer's, it's a 2016 Bentley Condo. So, yeah, I hope he doesn't mind, you know, but it's like, it has a double pane glass and all that stuff. So, you know, it's like a recording studio. That Lambo I was doing, and it was out of time, like it had an issue with the timing chains, right? So, mm-hmm. The degree of difficulty at a car like that is just higher because you typically have like no reference information. There's special tools required that you're obviously not going to own. When you do find, you know, reference information, it's in Italian half the time. So you sort of have to like figure it out. Modern mechanics, I always sort of like say, you know, I'm 38 and like, I feel like I was part of the last group of guys and girls to like actually learn how to work on cars and figure stuff out, figure out how to fix things instead of just like, you know, I have apprentices these days who are just like glued to their computer. I mean, they just Google shit, you know, like they're like, a car will come in and, you know, we'll be displaying, you know, X, Y, and Z symptoms, and they'll just walk over to the keyboard and just type that into Google. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like you're the customer at this point now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, can you figure out how to fix this thing on your own? You know, like, so I love it, man. I mean, I would be bored if I worked on something, a little bit more straightforward, you know, my mind might be warped from working for Land Rover for so long because British cars are just total piles of crap and, you know, they're just like weird electrical problems and weird this, that, and the other thing. So yeah, plus it's like the only way I'd ever get to drive any of these cars. I mean, I worked on a Lamborghini Countach the other day. That's like a car that was on my wall when I was 8 years old.
and mine.
Very quickly, within like 30 seconds was like, this car's a piece of shit and I don't even fit in it, right? So like, I wish I could have told my 8-year old self that, like, pick something more sensible, you know, like put a Ford Taurus on your wall or something.
what's one of your favorite stories that you tell about any of your mechanic work over the years?
Ooh, it's a tough one. You know, the guy who taught me how to work on cars, like when I was an apprentice, he was like crusty old guy named Russ, and he had lost all the feeling in his right hand. He had like been working on like a Super Duty pickup truck, and he was taking a brake rotor off of it and it fell, and he tried to catch it and it like severed all the tendons in his hand, right?
Oh my God.
Yeah, he had no feeling in his hand, and he, I remember one day, oh God, so I was working on a car, and he was working on a car in the bay next to me, and I smelled something, like, terrible, and I look over, and Russ has his hand on an exhaust manifold, right? He didn't even realize that he's, like, leaning his hand up against this, you know, 1,000-degree exhaust manifold, and his hand was just skin was, like, burning, you know? So I turned to him, and I couldn't get his name out of my mouth because I was so just shocked. I was like, and finally I screamed, Russ! And he pulls his hand up, and he looks at it. It's, like, bubbling. And he just looks at me, and he just laughs maniacally.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, this is a... So, like, several days later, he was showing me how to do something pretty basic, like test a relay or something. And he was like, you know, I was like, I had to put a jumper wire from one terminal to another on this thing. And he was like, no, just use a paper clip or something. And he instructed me to like take this paper clip and put one end of it in this one terminal and one in the other. And unbeknownst to me, he was like, just mechanics just have like demented senses of humor. He had basically had me holding a paperclip and instructed me to like short it out intentionally. Just like he was just pulling a prank on me, but, yeah. But you know, the paperclip, I'm looking at my thumb right now and I still have this giant U-shaped scar in my thumb from where the paperclip just hooked into my thumb. So yeah, I don't know. I don't have any stories about you about working on cars, but definitely the terror that was Russ, my first, you know, who I apprenticed with is, it stuck with me. I try and like treat my apprentices these days with more kindness and respect. I don't like electrocute them intentionally or cook my hand and then show it to them and laugh, you know.
I can't believe I'm laughing at this.
Yeah.
Yikes. So do you, if you had your preference, I mean, do you like mixing it up as professionally and doing the mechanic work and then the sports writing, or would you prefer to be full-time writing or what?
I mean, I've had opportunities to write full time. It would be a pay cut, you know. I've climbed the food chain, working on cars, you know. So it's a good living for me. And these days, obviously, it's tough to make decent money writing about soccer. There's like 10 dudes I feel like who do it, and then there's probably 50 to 100 who scrape by, and then there's like a legion of dudes who could be homeless at any moment, you know, but whatever, totally worth it to write about the San Jose earthquakes or something. I don't know. So like, you know, do I prefer it this way? I mean, it definitely keeps things interesting. On the other hand, there are days when like I literally will break away from working on a car to like write a piece, and it's like it is a difficult reset for my brain. You know, it's just like the two things are so different, man, that like, you know, it can be tough. And then also, I mean, like I work like 11, 12 hours a day on cars. So there are definitely days when I get home and I'm just like, no, I do not feel like writing about soccer right now, you know, but you know, at the end of the day, it's like, I'm super appreciative of the fact that people read my stuff and I'm like always eager to write and you know, feel obligated to do so, I think.
Well, just to wrap up here, cause I've kept you longer than I promised. There was, I think, a reference to this on your Twitter last week, and maybe this is mixing up your car interest and your soccer interest, about something, some story involving donuts in the RFK parking lot.
Oh, man. yeah, that was after the last game. I thought it was a 2013 season, but it turns out it was a 2014 season. Yeah, it's been long enough to where I can tell this one, I think.
Okay.
I left the game, and I was with the aforementioned Seth Bertelny. We were, you know, in lot 8A, which is this like the media parking lot at RFK, which is just like something out of Mad Max. And they're like, there's just you know, massive potholes and I don't know, people, you know, selling, people converting their urine to drinking water. I know, you know, whatever kind of stuff goes on there. Like, you know, it's a scary place. So we got there. I got in my car, which is just, it was an old you know, 80s Corvette. And, you know, it was like the last game of the year. We had, you know, it had been a grind that year. I was doing a beak egg for MLS soccer, and it was like 3-4 pieces a week. And, you know, sort of like I didn't have complete control over the content I was producing, a bunch of other stuff, so I just felt like blew it out. So I just did a bunch of donuts, and Seth filmed them, and I put it on my Instagram, and so later that night, so like, you know, in retrospect, I guess it's totally unprofessional, right? I mean, like, I don't know. I mean, like, I'm not, listen, I never, this was all thrust upon me, this whole soccer rating thing, so I don't know how to behave. So anyways, like, probably midnight, 1 a.m, I get a text from one of my editors at MLSsoccer.com. It says, it's a screenshot of an email, and the email is like one of the funniest things I've ever seen. It's from a DC United front office employee, and it says, the first paragraph is them trying to make small talk. It's like, tough loss tonight. I don't think it'll dampen, you know, anything that happened this year, though. Really proud of the guys. The second paragraph just goes, I'm not sure if you've seen, but Pablo posted a video of himself doing donuts in the RFK parking lot. We're going to have to get together and figure out how to move forward from this. It's like, so I get this screenshot of his email, and my editor is just like groggily, is like, dude, what the hell is this even? You know, like, what? And I was like, all right, well, first of all, it's true, you know. Second of all, you know, it was like, I think the editor was of the same opinion I was, which is, who the hell cares? It's like the RFK parking lots are like a third world country, and you know, who doesn't like doing donuts? And then to be extra offensive, the person who sent that email misspelled donuts. They spelled donuts like D-O-U-G-H, and that's not how you spell donuts in an automotive sense, at least, you know? So that's how square that person was. You know what I mean? Like, so yeah, but I survived. You know, it was like one of several things I did that angered the team that year. But you know, like, I emerged stronger on the other side, and now I'm doing an interview with Grant Wall and a customer's Bentley. So I don't know, everything's fine, I guess.
Well, this is the first time we've ever had someone from a Bentley come on the show. So I will consider that almost as much a victory as getting you on the show.
Oh, you know what else is funny? Sorry, I'll just interject this quickly. I have been working on a lot of MLS players as cars, right? I mean, like, when they figure out that I work on cars, I mean, dozens of these guys have like brought me their cars to work on, and I always joke, I worked on Patrick Nyarko's car the other day, mm-hmm. you know, ex MLS guy, and I was joking with him. I said, like, that I have a sliding scale for what I charge, and I base it on the union, on the public salary figures that are released by the players' union every year. So, like,
what do you say?
These guys in the league minimum, you know, probably $110 an hour. Designated players, it's like $300 an hour and up, you know. So,
could you tell me real quick what have you learned about MLS players' cars from having worked on them? Any lessons to take out of that?
No, it's like, you know what? It's a lot like, if you could say that MLS as a league is like a mid-tier kind of league, the cars that these guys drive are, they're also, it'd be like a BMW 3 Series or something like that, right? You know, and not, never like a Bentley or something like that. I mean, I feel like a BMW 3 Series is like the MLS player of cars, you know. It's like the 5 Series would be like you know, maybe like Bundesliga, and the 7 Series would be EPL. You know, so no, they all seem to drive kind of like mid-level, barely luxury type of cars. You know, so
that makes sense. I mean, like, the only time I've ever heard the term Bentley be used with an MLS player was Abel Xavier when I was doing my book research on the Galaxy, and he was with the Galaxy back in like 2007-08. Had like a white Bentley that he would wear all white. And, you know, he had the crazy dyed hair and beard.
Oh, my goodness. This is, like, one of the greatest visuals I've ever heard in my life.
And
like,
drive around town.
Abel Xavier, like, getting out of a white Bentley with that shock of blonde hair and an all-white suit. I mean, it's the only thing it's missing is, like, a parrot. Like, he would have a parrot on his shoulder for no reason. You know, like, that's incredible.
Yeah, that's actually one of my favorite RFK Stadium experiences of my career was when Abel Xavier didn't like that I was doing a book on his team and takes me into the John of the visiting locker room after, or actually, you know, post-game at RFK, and keeps saying over and over, "This is not correct! This is not correct. over and over and over again. And finally, I talked to Pete Vianis, who came in because he was friends with Abel. And I was like, I think he's unhappy about the book.
Yeah, this is not correct. I should not be in a bathroom stall with you right now.
But I would say this, that Abel is one of my favorite MLS players of all time. I could devote an entire podcast to him. He, when he got released by Ruud Gullit as, quote, a bad apple from the Galaxy, and he hated Abel so much that even though they had to eat his contract and it was still against the cap, it was like several hundred thousand dollars, they couldn't replace him, he still cut him. And then Abel, after he was no longer part of the team, contacts the team PR guy and wants to hold a press conference at the stadium, ripping Ruud Gullit, the coach. And the PR guy had to explain to Abel that they didn't do that for players who are no longer with the team.
My God. This is before the days when you could just, like, you know, fire up a Periscope or something like that.
Exactly.
And they're like, pull a Jermaine Jones and, like, put MLS on blast from your living room.
Yes.
And they're like,
yes.
Yeah.
I had no idea we were going to go down the road of Abel Xavier, but thank you so much for coming on the show. I really enjoyed that conversation.
Yeah, of course, man.
Thanks for listening to the Planet Football Podcast. I'd like to thank Pablo Maurer, as well as everyone at Cadence 13 and Sports Illustrated who supports this podcast. Please, if you like the pod, tell your friends, subscribe, like, and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. It really does help the cause if you do. And check out the 30-minute Planet Football video show hosted by me and Luis Miguel Echegaray on SITV. That's available on SI.TV, Amazon channels, and FuboTV. See you next time.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.